And right now, Rod Oram is in the Auckland studio. Good morning to you, Rod.
Good morning, Catherine.
Well, those swaps, those bank swaps that affected farmers have been a long-running story. This was around the time of the GFC. And one very long-running case has ended in success for the two farmers who brought it against a bank.
Indeed. Taranaki dairy farming couple Bill and Sharon Coomey have won a very significant victory against ANZ in the appeals court, and it's taken them 5 years of legal action to get this far. They'd complained that ANZ had failed to adequately warn them about the risks of an interest rate swap, which is a financial contract they'd entered into, and then failed to give them appropriate advice once the contract had become excessively expensive. And so this is a very rare example of bank customers achieving a big win after doggedly pursuing their bank through the courts at great expense over a long time with major setbacks along the way. And I'm grateful here to a sometime contributor tonight to noon, Nikki Mando, who has pieced this all together in a piece in Newsroom. And the origins of this go back to the early 2000s when banks here began selling interest rate swaps to farmers as a way for them to protect farmers to protect themselves against rising interest rates. Now, interest rate swaps have been around a long time. They are very complicated transactions involving counterparties organised by the banks, and usually it's only large and sophisticated corporate borrowers who enter into such swaps. And swaps became, of course, controversial because they can perform in very costly and aberrant ways in adverse market conditions, as they did during the global financial crisis 2008 and 2009. And then the question becomes, had the banks adequately identified the potential cost and risk to customers, and had they delivered to the customers all the help and assurances they had promised them? So that was the kind of the nub of the case. I've seen one estimate, and I can't vouch for its bona fides because it's a bit eye-watering. One estimate that about 2,000 New Zealand farmers had signed up to interest rate swaps in this period and subsequently lost up to $1 billion. And then the Commerce Commission investigated all this and in 2013 ordered the banks to pay $18.5 million of compensation payment to those farmers. So that's kind of the background to the story.
Right. No, sorry. No, you managed to time your pause for my colleague getting a chair through the door. So
right, you are. Distracted by a chair. No, quite right.
I was trying to see how quickly she could do it to see if I could let the pause carry on. But anyway.
Yeah, no, that's quite all right.
They were just carry on with the swaps. I mean, as you say, they were very curious instruments, but it wasn't really to the impact of the GFC that many began to see what they'd been sold.
Indeed. And although that very modest amount of compensation that was paid to all farmers, in that the Coomies, ANZ offered the Coomies $155,000 compensation, but they turned that down. And instead, they sued ANZ, seeking to recover up to $10 million of business losses and additional interest payments. I'll just make one note in passing here that they'd originally taken out this contract with National Bank, which then subsequently was taken over by ANZ, so it became an ANZ responsibility. Their very big setback was in November 2017, having gone to court in 2014, when the High Court ruled against them. And the judge said that ANZ didn't have a duty of care to the Coomies over any misrepresentation of the swaps, nor had the ANZ made any promises not to vary the interest margin on the swaps. And moreover, the Coomies had signed bank documents with clear disclaimers. So basically, the judge was saying it was, buyer beware. Very interestingly, though, she not only awarded ANZ costs against the Coomies, but actually increased those costs by 50% because she said the Coomies had acted unreasonably by not accepting two pre-trial offers of compensation from ANZ seeking to settle. And by this point, the Coomies' legal fees were well into six figures.
So At that point, I suppose you've got a choice, really. What was theirs?
They didn't give up. And so they went to the appeals court and took almost, another 2.5, almost another couple of years. And 3 weeks ago, the appeals court overturned the High Court and ordered ANZ to compensate the Kumis and put the task of deciding that sum back to the High Court. But I'll just highlight a bit of the language of the three appeals court judges, because they identified that the National Bank staff had given, quote, false and misleading, unquote, information to the Kumis. And I'm just going to read a couple of sentences here where the judges wrote, "We do not think it fair and reasonable that ANZ should be able, in effect, to say to the Kumis, notwithstanding what we promised we would do and what we represented to be true, you have no claim against us, even though we did not do what we said we would do and what we represented to you was false." Now, ANZ's response on this is that it hasn't decided yet whether it appealed to the Supreme Court. And moreover, they argue that interest rate swaps are a legitimate product to sell to farmers. However, since 2008, their practices of how to sell and manage such derivatives have been, quote, extensively reviewed and changed. And one of the things they are requiring people to do is to sign up appropriate documentation when they enter into, such contracts to acknowledge that they understand the product and that the ANZ has recommended they seek appropriate external advice. There's, of course, this whole controversy with the swaps saga is largely done. And so, full marks the Kumis for pressing on to this point. But there's quite a strong level of farmer unhappiness with other aspects of bank practices. And so that's why, for example, there's running through Parliament at the moment is a farm debt mediation bill to try to find more effective mechanisms to resolve disputes between farmers and banks before the banks take action against the farmers, which obviously can lead in some cases to the farmers losing their properties.
It's interesting with these instruments, and that the essence of the case was not that the instruments exist or should exist, but it came down to the way they were sold and who was doing the selling and the nature of the selling, almost a duty of care to reveal downsides. It sounds like that actually formed or was the basis of the couple's case?
Yes, absolutely. So, for example, the Kumis believed reasonably that ANZ had promised to give the bank would present options to them if necessary, such as particularly breaking the swap contracts, i.e. Paying a break fee to get out of them. But when they were pressing ANZ to give them options like that, the bank was very tardy in doing so, at which point the break fee was really considerable. As memory serves, it was kind of over $1.5 million. There is quite a long trail all the way through this legal proceedings of ANZ, as the appeals court said, misrepresenting what it was selling and then failing to adequately support the customers in the way it had promised it would. I think it really throws into sharp relief the lower court judgment, and it's good to see this verdict from the appeals court.
Their tenacity is extraordinary. Many, many others affected. I thought there was some talk even of some kind of a class action, but I cannot recall, because it was some time ago, what happened.
No, I'm afraid I can't either, and I failed to look that up last night. I don't know whether at this stage this might embolden others or encourage others. Certainly if people have settled with ANZ and the other banks, they would then have no recourse. But there may still be some people out there who, who are still also wrestling with this. But the sums were truly extraordinary. And, interest rate swaps have been around a very long time, but they are very complicated. With all due respect to farmers who often very savvy about business, it was a very inappropriate, and I would disagree with ANZ that it's still an appropriate product to sell to farmers.
Now, we'd previously talked to MMP. In fact, I'd interviewed their chief executive over the plans to sell their life insurance business. In fact, more than life insurance, I think health insurance and may have been in there as well. But just help me clarify, sell off their life insurance business to Resolution Life. That deal looks like it's fallen over.
It has, and it was a big deal for AMP. This was their insurance business, both sides of the Tasman. They hoped to scoop up about $3.3 billion Australian dollars from doing this. And the stumbling block is that they had failed to understand or ask. I don't think they, apparently from what I'm reading, they hadn't even asked the Reserve Bank here in New Zealand as the insurance regulator what would be required. And so they were rather surprised to discover that under New Zealand regulation, the Reserve Bank would require them not to ship these assets from these policies off overseas into a tax haven, which is Resolution Life's modus operandi, but to ring fence the assets here in New Zealand to protect them for the life insurance holders. I should explain how this product works. This is called zombie insurance, whereby an insurer stops writing new policies and a company like Resolution Life buys up the existing portfolio of financial assets that underpin the existing policies. And so those policies are still honoured in due course. And there's quite a lot of controversy around it. Resolution Life, led by Clive Cowdery, has attracted some controversy, and it's been very big in this business over the last 15, 16 years. It's done about almost $14 billion worth of such transactions. But it's not without controversy. And so that's what the Reserve Bank was trying to protect. It's not clear where this goes from here. The announcement from AMP and Resolution was that this is kind of the end of the road. But there are some suggestions around whether the cost of ring-fencing the appropriate volume of assets in New Zealand could be jointly met by the two of them so the deal could go ahead. So I wouldn't, you know, this is really important to AMP as it's trying to restructure, rebuild, re-strategize, rebuild its credibility, that they do sell these assets, and there's not many other buyers around because insurers have been offloading a lot of such assets, so there's not many buyers out there.
Weren't they going to spin off their wealth management arm as well and list that? Did that happen?
Yeah, no, they ran into problems with that too, as I remember, although that's still a plan in Australia. But as I understand it, the way this is going to work out now, that it'll be floated in Australia, but not separately in New Zealand. It'll just be a trans-Tasman business that's operating here, I think. I could be wrong about that. But certainly there were problems with that side as well. So, in other words, AMP has come seriously unstuck on its big plans to try and give itself a new lease on life.
And we've talked about stock market listings or the lack of them. There is a new one, and it's an actual physical infrastructure.
Yes, this is a Napier Port. Hawke's Bay Regional Council owns 100% of it. It's going to sell 45% of it on the stock market in late August. And it hopes to... The sale will value the port at about $500 million all up. It's the fourth largest port in the country. So from that share sale... about half the proceeds will go to repay the port's existing debt, and the other half will help fund a long-term investment project that's going to cost $200 million. And this is to build a big new sixth wharf, which should be 350 metres long so it could handle some of the world's largest cruise ships, which increasingly Hawke's Bay attracts. And but that necessitates dredging the shipping channel to deepen it down to 13.5 metres. So there's lots of work to do over the next couple of years. And Hawke's Bay residents and non-resident taxpayers are being offered the chance to buy shares, and they are guaranteed a minimum of $2,000 worth of shares as they apply, and port employees too. Should they apply, they've been guaranteed a minimum of $5,000 worth of shares. I've resisted the temptation. I'm going to have to say it anyway, because normally we use a particular verb about stock market listings, but it seems inappropriate to talk about the port, Napier Port, floating on the stock market. It sounds a little insubstantial. Sorry.
Tell me how the listing will happen, though. So you're guaranteed a dollar value of shares, but you won't know what that number, or just remind me what happens with a brand new float, actually, and it is the term, because do they float at a set price? Because they move straight away, don't they? So there's a list price, and do we know what that is?
No, the first step is called book building, where the investment bankers go out and ask institutional investors, at this kind of price, how many shares would you want? So that gives them a profile and helps them pitch a price, and then that becomes the price that the shares open on the stock exchange. And of course, depending on demand for more or a desire to sell, the price could go up or down. But in this process, whatever that price is, that will be translated into X number of shares at that price for that minimum shareholding of $2,000 for ratepayers or five residents to or $5,000 for employees.
So 110, or they will raise, they anticipate raising, will raise $200 million.
As I remember, the range they're talking about is perhaps around about $2.50 a share.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Rod Oram, business commentator.